Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the price of oil, and there will be news coming out this week that the price, that the profits that oil companies will be receiving will be quite significant, if not record profits. There's also information that we are giving $4 billion a year in fossil fuel subsidies, and you don't need me to tell you this, but to be specific, gas prices have jumped more than 12 cents over the past 2 weeks. The average gallon is 23 cents off the all-time high of $4.11 sent in July of 2008. Gasoline has risen 70 cents a gallon since February 18 and $1.19 in the last 7 months. Our guest the first hour of the program has concerns about the fuel industry in this country, concerns about drilling, has done a great deal of research and written several books on this topic. Exxon's profits, I wanted to tell you, are expected to rise this year by 50%, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. Our guest this hour is Antonia Housas, a leading oil industry expert and director of the energy program at Global Exchange. She is the author of a couple books, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. She's also the author of The Tyranny of Oil and the Bush Agenda and editor of The True Cost of Chevron, an alternative annual report 2009 and 2010. She is a former legislative assistant to two members of Congress, and she is an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and on the National Advisory Board of Iraq Veterans Against the War. We're welcoming phone calls. What makes me think we're going to have plenty of them this hour? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. You can always send an email as well. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Antonia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with the record profits that will be announced this week. It could be up to 50% more. Why record profits for oil companies right now? And what do you imagine they're going to be?
Well, unfortunately, from my perspective, what we're looking at is the market essentially resettling itself back where it was before the financial crisis, much of which, by the way, was caused by the rise in the price of oil. And in 2008, everyone will probably remember, oil reached up to nearly $150 a barrel. It was actually when oil went to $100 a barrel that the start of the economic crisis began and was just pushed over the edge by oil getting to $150 a barrel. We're basically back on track to get oil that high again. And oil is the primary source of income for oil companies. They make some money off of gasoline, but their bread and butter is their oil. And as goes the price of oil, so goes the profits of the major oil companies. In 2008, we saw all of them hit records, but that was a trend. So Exxon earned the highest profits of any corporation in world history in 2003. It topped them every single year up to 2008, and then had a dip in 2009. It was climbing back up in 2010, and now it's right back up there. And that's the same with basically all of the world's major oil companies.
And what are they doing with all that money? They say that they need it for reinvestment to find new sources of oil.
Sure, but we're talking profit. So, that's after they've spent their money. That's they've taken in their revenue. They've spent money on the things they need to spend money on, the largest piece of which is exploring for and producing oil for sure. But, this is what's left over in the end is the profit. So these profits are just there. There's no comparison. So, for example, Walmart is the largest corporation in the world by revenue, but its profits were one quarter those of Exxon last year. So Walmart made the year before, $11 billion versus $40-some billion for Exxon. So the world's banks on occasion rival the size of the oil companies, again, in terms of revenue, but there just isn't, in terms of profits, any financial comparison to the major oil companies. And one of the things they are increasingly doing with that money, as you talked about the attempt to try and cut some of those subsidies at the beginning, as a result of the ruling in Citizens United by the Supreme Court, which lifted the restrictions on how much money companies can spend on campaigns, whereas in the past we would see oil companies spend about 11 times more money on lobbying than they spent on campaigns. Now that that restriction is gone, we're starting to see their campaign spending double, triple, quadruple, and I think that's going to be a new place for us to see that money take hold.
And perhaps one of the reasons we haven't seen much congressional movement on the $4 billion a year in fossil fuel subsidies?
Yeah, sure. And that number is actually very small. In fact, President Obama, ever since he took office, has tried to eliminate more like about $40 billion in subsidies total to the oil and gas industry. And each budget, he's been beaten back by the Republicans. And right now, the Republicans are actually getting ready to introduce in May a whole series of bills for the industry, including ones that are attempts to expand further offshore and other forms of drilling.
And what's in it in their interest to do this?
Wasn't it in their interest is they can produce more oil and sell it, of course, and that's where they make their bread and butter. Also, book more reserves. So basically, the more a company can say, I own this oil here, it's mine, and I can produce it when I want to, the higher their share price goes and the more valuable the company is. But in terms of what it does for us, which is probably a more important question, it's very important to note in terms of oil prices. In the United States right now, we're producing more oil right today than we were at this time last year. But prices, of course, of both oil and gasoline are dramatically higher than they were. So when we produce more oil, it doesn't really have anything to do with the one supply of oil that stays in the United States because the oil companies export oil and gasoline out of the United States. And it also has very little to do at this point to do with price. In the United States, the oil industry considers us to be in a state of an oil glut, too much oil. So they're exporting it out. It's overflowing from storage facilities. They're literally dripping in it, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. So if we started drilling more dangerous drilling, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, it would create a lot of danger, but it wouldn't do anything for the price of oil or gas.
So what is the answer to the question? If we have a glut right now, why have prices gone up $1.19 gasoline in the past 7 months?
The primary determinant for the price of gasoline is definitely the price of oil. The price of oil has been catapulting almost exclusively for one reason, and that's speculation. And that means that basically, the run-up in the price of oil to $150 a barrel began in 2000 when regulation of futures trading in oil was essentially eliminated by the creation of a new exchange called the Intercontinental Exchange that was a non-regulated trading place for oil. As more and more and more trading moved to that unregulated exchange, the price of oil began to skyrocket. And there's two reasons for that. One is the trading itself creates a demand. It's an artificial demand. More people are trading oil. It means there's a greater demand for oil, which means the price goes up. But also, it's unregulated. So we have no idea the size of the trades, who's behind them, if there is manipulation taking place, what's really driving that price so high. The only reason why the price fell is because our economy collapsed, and one of the global economy. And one of the reasons why the global economy collapsed is because the global economy can't handle $100 a barrel oil, much less $150 a barrel oil. But now the economy's coming back. The energy traders are moving back into their trading. Speculation is moving more and more rapidly, and nothing has changed to the underlying problem. No regulations have been introduced. So really the market is sort of, from their perspective, righting itself. The speculation is running rampant, and the price is running right with it. Then for gasoline, of course, the price of gasoline always rises with the price of oil, but I'm sure listeners are familiar with this phenomena that we call rockets and feathers. So the price of oil goes up, the price of gas goes up immediately. But when the price of oil comes down, the price of gasoline feathers slowly back down. And what that means is that oil isn't the only determinant of the price of gas. And in the United States, we have a highly concentrated market with just a few oil companies controlling the vast majority of our refining capacity and the gas stations. Mm-hmm. So they have a strong ring around the price of gasoline as well.
Let's go back to this non-regulated exchange, which started some problems. Why did we get a non-regulated exchange? Who made that decision and why?
That was a decision, that can be traced back to Phil and Wendy Graham, basically what we had was banks and oil companies pushing to get energy trades deregulated. They came together to do this. They lobbied the federal government. A deregulation was slipped into a huge omnibus budget deal that was passed under the Clinton administration. But the people who really were the closest behind it were Phil Graham and his wife Wendy Graham, and they slipped in what's been referred to as the Enron loophole, because the immediate beneficiary was the Enron Corporation, which then used this loophole to manipulate the price of electricity. And they were caught manipulating the price of electricity eventually, and Enron, you know, collapsed as a result of that manipulation. But the Enron energy traders live on, and they work now at oil companies, and they work now for energy hedge funds. And essentially, they're doing to the price of oil what they were doing before to the price of electricity, and they're doing it through this new market that they created, or this new platform they created called the Intercontinental Exchange, that is unregulated, whereas the New York Mercantile Exchange, which had been the primary place where oil was traded, remains regulated, but the trading has shifted off, and we've basically, since that moment, since 2000, seen this dramatic climb in the price of oil.
Don't you run a risk when you talk about the economy coming back, which indications are it is a little bit? How can an economy come back at all, if not backtrack, when you've got the price of oil this high and the price of gas? People can't afford it.
It's a huge, huge problem of concern. Basically, history tells this lesson over and over again, three times. The price of oil goes to $100 a barrel. The result is a global recession. We are just too hardwired for this product, and economies can't handle $100 a barrel oil, much less $110, much less $120, which is where we're at now, much less $150. And unless those underlying regulations are changed to rein in speculation, we will see this as an ongoing problem. But even more importantly to me, the end result isn't just regulating. It is that the price of oil should be high. There are a lot of externalities, environmental concerns, human rights concerns, democracy concerns. The price of gas should be high. We create enormous problems with our consumption of gasoline. However, we should be capturing that price, we meaning government, so that we can invest it into all the things we need to do to get off of these resources altogether, so that our economies aren't so hardwired to these products, rather than going into these insane, unnecessary profits for Exxon and Chevron and Conoco.
Well, I've asked this question for the many years I've been doing talk shows. I remember living through the Jimmy Carter time when we waited in line for gasoline, and there was some attempt and a serious discussion about our being hardwired to this product and how we could change that, and we never do. Why don't we?
Well, we do in fits and starts. So the American public is actually utilizing less gasoline now than we have for some time, and it's estimated that 2007 is actually going to be our peak consumption year for gasoline. The reason is, one, the economy, of course, it's more expensive, but the other is consumers are demanding different types of products. So we're actually seeing, you know, Priuses all over the place, hybrids, electric cars. People are asking for public transportation, and the Obama administration has responded with, you know, huge public money for light rail, although some places are turning it away. Mm-hmm. There has been a push for and a response for more fuel-efficient cars and other options, and I think we are asking for it, not only out of economic need, but out of a realization that we really have to fundamentally change the way we live. And in the United States, you know, our use of gasoline is how we use oil. So 80% of our consumption of oil is for our cars and our trucks and our airplanes. And people are starting to shift. And I definitely think the Obama administration has made this a priority, but not enough. I think there needs to be clearly regulation, as I said, of the futures markets, but also an aggressive attempt to eliminate these massive subsidies that we provide for this industry and create a massive investment. What I would argue for is public transportation.
We welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number. Call in early if you have thoughts. I would imagine we're going to have many calls on this. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. With oil companies expected to release record profits later this week and subsidies for fossil fuel at an all-time high and, as our guest just said, a non-regulated exchange here. So we don't exactly know what speculators are doing. All of this contributing to the price of oil. What do we do about it? Because we can't afford it. It's too much money, and maybe there are some less than honorable things taking place here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest is Antonia Juhas, a leading oil industry expert, director of the energy program at Global Exchange. She is author of Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. She spent a great deal of time on the Gulf, meeting with people, and she also went to London at a meeting of BP. We'll ask her to talk about that during the course of this hour. She's also the author of The Tyranny of Oil. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Rebecca in Warrens. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say that, you know, when you have a company or you have, like, the oil industry making big profits, there's usually another side to every story. And I've heard about, you know, people that invest in oil and people who have, like, their retirement funds, you know, they're invested in that. And so when the price of the oil goes up and, you know, it's high per barrel, that's good for them because then, you know, then their retirement funds will grow. And so I was just curious if maybe you would have someone else who would come on and point out things that the other side of the story.
What do you think about what you've heard?
I think that oil is expensive because it's in high demand and it's a necessity. Although eventually I think we will move out of having to have oil as the primary driver of our that we won't need oil for, like, our energy as much as we do right now. I think right now we do need it, so we need to be wise about, well, you know, it's like, well, we can drive up the price of oil, but if we're trying, we don't have anything, you know, that'll replace it without pouring a bunch of government money into it, I think we have to be wise about it.
What do you think about record profits for oil companies?
Well, that's what I'm saying about, like, the other side to every story. I mean, these profits, you know, are the people that work for the company, are they getting, you know, I think it's like, well, they're all making record profits, and that's such a terrible thing when we're all paying so much for gasoline, which, yes, it is. It's really annoying, you know, when I think that I have to go to the pump and I have a pretty, you know, energy-efficient car, and I don't drive a lot, but, you know, I have to pay all this money while they're making all this money. But at the same time, you know, if I work for that company and I'm getting the benefit of that, you know, maybe I would see it differently.
Antonia.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. So the first is, yes, there are people who are immediately benefiting. These are publicly traded companies, which means that there are public investors that are receiving money. The problem is sort of the broader sort of social loss and benefit. So, you know, for example, what I think is a problem for these companies having such large profits, for example, is the massive subsidies that we provide to this industry. So it's the wealthiest industry the world has ever known, yet we subsidize it to the tune of $40 billion a year. That isn't a good, you know, social economic trade-off to me. So if the industry is going to make so much money,
great, but let's say, so therefore the government doesn't need to give you $40 billion a year. And let's look at that trade-off. If the industry is going to make so much money, we should be able and be in a better position to tax the industry more appropriately. At the end of the day, the oil industry, like many large corporations, end up paying about zero in taxes, which, of course, doesn't seem to make sense. And that's when you balance out the subsidies to the amount of taxes that they're paying out. And then we are dependent on this resource, but it's also a problematic resource. So what we need to also be able to do is, in a democracy in particular, balance out the wealth of that industry and the amount that it's able to spend on lobbying and campaigns and influencing public policy decisions so that we can have an equal voice and try and make that shift to the alternatives, like you said, because even though the industry talks a lot about investing in alternative energy, they don't at all. And in fact, they've been cutting their alternative investments. At its height, BP was actually the largest investor in alternatives. And at its height, it spent 4% of its budget on alternative energy. That's been cut down to closer to about 1.5%, and that's a closer percentage for most of the companies. And so if we really want to see the transition, we're going to have to utilize public resources to invest in that transition. We're going to have to sort of wrest some of those public resources from the oil industry, and we're going to have to put a tighter rein on the industry because it's going to try and get all of that oil that it can, and it's going to take intense risks to get that oil, such as in the Gulf of Mexico. And again, it's our public policy decisions that need to balance those risks. And I think that there are places that we just shouldn't be going for the rest of the world's oil while we remain dependent upon it.
What about this transition to some alternative? Is this technologically very expensive and very difficult, and that's why the process is so slow?
No, it's not the technology that's difficult. As you say, we've had the capacity since the Carter administration, if not earlier, to know how to invest in solar and wind technology and biofuels. There's really been an enormous political obstacle, which in my mind has been the industry that profits on things remaining as they are. And for a long time, that was the automobile industry, but it's slowly been wrenched into starting to respond to changes, and the oil industry. And you know, the restrictions on the ability of the federal government and state governments and local governments to take resources and put them into things like public transportation. Budgets for public transportation have been cut and cut and cut, which means that if you want to leave your car at home and instead take public transit, at this point it's expensive, it's inefficient, and, you know, that's just a matter of public investment dollars.
Thanks for the call, Rebecca. Mike is next in Oregon. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just got back from Europe, and the last tank of gas we bought cost us 7.5 for an American gallon. I'm not sure that $4 a gallon is that bad in that light. But here's my question. I understand why the price of gas is slow to respond to a drop in the price of oil. Why is the converse also true, that when the price of oil goes up, surely they are selling stuff that they bought at a lower price? Why is the price of gas immediately reflected?
Great question. Basically, it's a sign of the fact that there's other things driving the price of gasoline than the price of oil. And here in the United States, that is primarily due to the fact that the industry is so concentrated that the number of refineries has been shrinking for years, but particularly in the past couple of years, we lost about 7 refineries, which is good. If you live near a refinery, you don't want to have one there, but creates more concentration in the market. And gas stations are very concentrated, which means that what the oil companies are able to do is take advantage of the fact that we can see that the price of oil has gone up, so they can say, oh, that's why the price of gas has gone up so quickly, even though in fact, doesn't need to rise that quickly. But they stay shy of actual collusion. I doubt that they actually sit in a room together and say, let's, you know, set the price of gasoline. But it's very easy for them to look at each other's gas stations and set them all in the same general range. And that is just due to, you know, lack of real competition, real concentration within the industry.
An email from John in Milwaukee. I've heard the U.S. consumes about 3 times the amount of oil that we produce. Is this true? And is the oil produced by the U.S. a significant enough amount to affect the market price if it's true that we consume 3 times as much as we produce?
Let me get these numbers right. We're the third highest producer of crude, but we basically, well, sorry, can you say the question one
yeah,
more time?
I've heard that let's take it part by part. The U.S. consumes about 3 times the amount of oil that we produce. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. But we also export out oil and import in oil. We have about a 50-50% balance. So we import about 50% of our petroleum products, about half of the petroleum that we use is imported, but we're also exporting products.
And is the oil produced by the United States a significant enough amount to affect the market price?
We're the third largest producer of oil in the world, but we're also the hands down the largest consumer. The amount of oil that we produce can certainly influence the price of oil. The problem is that the model that I explained for the United States is also a problem that is a quote-unquote problem that is existing in the global trade of crude, which is that those who produce crude see the global market also as glutted, that there's too much supply based on demand. And you have oil and storage facilities all around the world. There was, of course, a dip in supply due to the events in Libya, but the Libyan rebels already have an oil minister. That oil minister is already making deals for oil with the world, and most of that supply, in any case, affects the European market. And at this point, you know, even Saudi Arabia, when it talks about whether it's going to produce or reduce the amount of oil that it's supplying, really at the end of the day, most everyone knows that it's the decisions that the speculators are making that is the dominant dominant influencer on the price of oil. And unless we made dramatic changes in production, the United States or Saudi Arabia, those fluctuations don't have as much of an impact on the price.
Tom in Burlington. Hi.
I studied economics at Georgetown University, and I put out a press release in July of 2008, and it hit the market like a bomb, and the speculators started running, and the price dropped dramatically over 6 months. But what I want to say about the situation as I see it, there has to be a political shift in this country. The Midwestern Republican base is really not served by the oil patch Republican base, and the election after election, they keep voting Republicans in when the Republicans are really not on their side, and they haven't learned this yet. For instance, we had our governor here in Walker, our Governor Walker, he vetoed the $1 billion super speed train they were going to put here, and if he had put that train in and just put a little spur up to the Wisconsin Dells, he could have attracted all these people from Chicago, and we could have brought in billions of tourists up here.
All right, let's talk about that. It's not just the governor of Wisconsin who's done this. It's other governors as well. What's the reason for that, do you see? Is it related to – what's it related to, Antonia?
I thought you were asking him. I think it's clearly two pieces. It's a political tactic to show – Tea Party and other conservatives that these are elected officials that are willing to take a stand against the Obama administration, even if I would certainly argue that it's a stand that shoots yourself in the foot at the same time you're trying to make a gesture, a political gesture. It also very well services the interests of the oil industry and the automobile industry to not have massive investments in public transportation. And I hope that lobbying is not the reason, but I have a feeling that it is. And I agree with the caller. You know, basically, you've got the broader interest, I would agree, of the Republican Party being harmed by a position that is basically just, we will say no to everything that President Obama does, even if it's something that would help us, such as light rail and taking money to see light rail put into place. One of the reasons why gasoline can be so high in Europe and not cause massive disruptions in the economy is because the economy has shifted so largely to public transit, and people have meaningful other options when the price of gasoline goes up to $7 a gallon. Here, of course, $7 a gallon gasoline would be devastating, even though I think that is what the price actually should be, because we just haven't put in those investments for other modes of transportation.
Rick in South Range, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. And your guest, I have been made aware more consciously in the last few years than ever in my 60-some years that I have control over how much gasoline I use for the most part, but I don't have any control over the cost and availability of heating oil, propane, and the other fossil fuels that we use to heat our homes and our buildings. And that's a staggering amount of money. But all I seem to hear is, boy, gasoline is high. This is awful. I don't have to drive to town to get a hamburger for lunch today. I can cook a hot dog here at home. But I have no control over the cost of heating my structure and our schools and our government buildings. It's a horrific amount of money. What I'm asking is, the problem isn't just the price of gasoline, is it?
No, that's an excellent point. Actually, one of the largest market manipulations in the futures market in the last several years was a multi-billion dollar manipulation of the natural gas market. And as an earlier caller had asked about public investments in oil companies, there are definitely public investments in natural gas providers and pensions invested in natural gas providers. And those pensions were crushed by this manipulation that radically drove the price of natural gas up, and then was exposed as a price manipulation. And there's definitely the same lack of regulation in oil futures is the same in natural gas, also used for home heating, and the same need for regulation that applies oil and gas, to oil futures and gasoline futures also applies to natural gas as well.
And that certainly was a point of contention among some Democrats, with the president's budget proposing a cut in home heating assistance.
Absolutely. So again, this is making a trade-off between, is public policy going to help those who I would argue really need it, such as paying to heat your home, or is public policy going to help speculators who are making billions of dollars off these trades? Hopefully we should be trying to direct public policy to the former and not the latter.
Thanks for the call. Habu in Madison, hi.
Good morning. This is very enlightening. I have just a comment, and that I don't think this has been spelled out clearly enough. I've worked in the oil industry and, in full disclosure, own 5,000 shares of Exxon, but that's another story. And I'm not defending it, but I see no reason why the oil industry should not have its share of profits just like any other industry in this nation. The pharma makes mega profits. The insurance industries and healthcare, et cetera, make mega profits. There's no reason to target one, even though it's a social good, but healthcare too. But I want to illustrate one thing that has not been clearly spelled out, and that is the whole issue of manipulation of the market. Apparently, the world is awash in oil, and even the OPEC has said that. And Saudi Arabia just the other day said they're cutting back production in the light of prices going up. And this points out how the market is manipulated. What used to be a futures market once upon a time, where only those people who would actually take delivery or make delivery were buying these contracts. But now pension funds and the hedge funds are making a killing. And this is just one incident to show how bad this has gotten. In 2009, after the bailout, a disgruntled Citibank executive did not like that he was not getting his full share of his bonuses. And what he did was he bought oil and put it on empty tankers and sent them around the world to jack up the price of oil. And this has been well documented by a professor from Maryland. His name escapes me. But this is the situation. It is not so much the actual supply and demand of oil as much as the manipulation in Wall Street and the City of London on oil futures.
Antonia.
Yeah, absolutely. But I wouldn't limit it to Wall Street and London. Oil companies, actually possibly with the only exception of Exxon, also engage in speculative trading, and they have to report it, and they do. And one of the reasons is that, as I said before, the Enron energy traders went to work for the oil industry. So, for example, Chevron not only bought Enron's former headquarters in Houston, it also bought its trading floor and hired many of its energy traders. And so you've got energy traders also working inside of oil companies. You also have them, as the caller very rightly says, working inside of banks. And the banks are in many ways becoming a hybrid with oil companies. They're actually buying tankers, they're buying pipelines, buying fields, and there's an enormous problem of insider trading due to that. But there is, great motivation on both sides to push the price higher, and we're not able to regulate it. So speculation also includes the oil companies themselves. Exxon is the exception because Exxon doesn't need to engage in speculation. It is the biggest profit house in the world has ever known. It doesn't need to do anything that's risky. In terms of picking on the oil companies, it is important to note, yes, pharma is big, and weapons manufacturers are big, but they're not big in any way remotely close to the size of the profits of the oil industry. There just is no comparison. And again, I don't have a problem with that in the abstract. Sure, oil companies should make profits and people can benefit from that. Again, it's the way that those resources are used, and it's the way that they're acquired. And one of the ways that they're acquired is on all of our backs, which is the subsidies that we provide the industry and the lack of regulation that we enforce on the industry, and the industry's ability to continue to produce oil in places where I think it shouldn't and make a profit from that. So that's where the sort of picking on the oil industry comes in from my side.
We haven't even talked about the environmental risks that they're subjecting all of us to, and you've spent a lot of time in your latest book looks at the huge crisis in the Gulf BP caused.
Yeah, so my latest book, Black Tide, is about the Gulf oil disaster. And, of course, we have an ongoing fight going on right now with Republicans in Congress and also oil state Democrats trying to aggressively expand offshore drilling in the Gulf, but also in the rest of the United States, off of the Atlantic, off of the Pacific, more places in Alaska. And what I found in writing my book and reading every single commission that studied the Deepwater Horizon disaster is that the oil industry really doesn't know how to do this type of deep water drilling. They learned on the fly how to cap this blowout, and there's no reason to believe that the cap that they devised for this Macondo blowout is one that is truly applicable in other instances. And also, the cap didn't really reassure anyone because we weren't sure that the well was dead until the relief wells were drilled, and that took 5 long months. And it seems to me that that's the only thing that we can be sure of will stop another blowout, which means 5 months worth potentially of oil. And also, the oil industry had no capacity to deal with the spill, even though they said they could handle 300,000 barrels of oil a day. They couldn't even handle 80,000 barrels. They didn't have containment ships. They didn't have underwater vehicles. They didn't have boom. They didn't have skim. And they also had no new technology. So the same failed technology that, in response to the Valdez, cleaned up only 14% of the oil was the exact same technology that was applied to the Gulf.
Moreover, you know, 11 men died on that rig. I spent a good deal of time with some of the family members of those men who died. And one family member in particular, Keith Jones, whose son Gordon died, has made very clear that he blames greed and the hubris of the oil industry, BP, Transocean, Halliburton, for rolling the dice with his son's life and losing. And the problems that he identifies are problems that all of the commissions have found is endemic and systemic to the entire industry, not just BP.
Antonio Yuhas, our guest this hour, a leading oil industry expert, author of Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, and also The Tyranny of Oil. Our phone number, Habu, thanks for your call, is 800-486-8655. We're trying to understand why the price of oil is so high, which translates, of course, to gasoline in many parts of the state, $4 a gallon and up. Home heating oil costs are very, very high, and we're looking at that coupled with record profits for oil companies and lack of regulation of the industry and subsidizing the industry as well. How do we put it all together? I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, the author of It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. It's the story of an unlikely trio in a very, very devastatingly poor part of Kenya who build a non-governmental organization to help a new generation of leaders from within. The organization is Carolina for Kibera, which is now a pioneer of the movement called Participatory Development. And our guest has received awards for his work. He was named, he also is a Marine who fought in Iraq and now works in the sustainability office at Duke Energy. He was named Person of the Year in 2006 for his work in Kibera and in the Marine Corps. So he's joining us, our number two. Back to phone calls, Jeff in Milwaukee. Hello. Jeff, are you there? Jeff is gone. We go to Bill in Jackson. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'd like to make two points. One is a political point, and one is a common sense. To me, I think the Democrats have to realize that the strategy that they're on is going to sink them in the next election by allowing fuel costs to go up so high, because they're still seen as being in charge, and people are going to look at them next year, especially if the fuel prices remain high, and they're going to take it out on the Democrats, and I don't want to see that, especially in this state. The other thing is that I believe what needs to be done, a lot of oil-producing countries keep some of their own oil for themselves first, and then the extra that they have, they put on the market, but not this country. I think we should do that, too. I think a lot of oil that's made here should stay here and not go on the open market, because we're not Europe. We're not a small, condensed area. The United States needs inexpensive energy, mainly oil and natural gas, to heat homes. Otherwise, we're going to go down. And look at 3 years ago, we're still not come back from that. And if the fuel prices, stay high, people are going to stop making their mortgage payments again, and just pay for gas and food to get to work and survive. And that's how it is for the common man. And I guess that's it for now.
All right, thank you, Bill, for the call, Antonia.
Yeah, I think, let's see, there's two answers. One is, yes, we need to be worried, as the caller said, and I said earlier, about the price of oil and the price of gasoline getting higher. The problem, though, is even if we kept U.S. oil here to be used here, if manipulation and speculation was still driving the price of oil. Again, this sort of the balance between supply and demand is completely out of whack and has been for many years. It wouldn't guarantee that it would change the price of oil and price of gas, and probably would not change the price of oil and price of gas to just maintain a supply for ourselves here. And that rather, again, we need to look at this broader issue of regulation. It's the same type of problems, by the way, that led to the mortgage crisis, the same type of lack of regulation and oversight of the use of mortgages, the trading in mortgages, the trading in derivatives. none of which has been resolved, none of which has been changed, is the same type of problem and many of the same actors that are manipulating the price of oil and the price of gasoline. But again, I also don't think that the answer is to artificially maintain low oil or gasoline prices, because there are extreme consequences of being as reliant as we are on this resource as the source becomes harder and harder to get to. So it's not that the oil industry likes to be, operate in dangerous places such as the deep water and likes to lose the lives of 11 of its employees. Of course it doesn't. But it's willing to take that risk to get the oil that is out there. It's willing to fight wars. It's willing to, and so are we apparently, engage in incredibly environmentally and socially harmful practices to get this resource. And at the end of the day, we do have alternatives. We can use less of it. We can invest more heavily in the alternatives that do work and try as hard as we can and as quickly as we can to get ourselves off of this resource. And one of the ways of doing that is capturing the wealth of this industry, and instead of giving them our money, capturing some of it back and using that money to invest in the transition.
Would you agree with his comment that the price of gas particularly does have political ramifications, that people use their cars a lot in this country and they're going to blame this administration for making it expensive for them?
Well, I've been listening to a lot of conservative radio lately, and that's definitely the message that the conservatives are telling to their audience, which is blame the Democrats, mm-hmm. Blame Obama. But I actually think that the American public doesn't have quite that short of a memory, and one of the reasons why, even though the oil and gas industry spent more money than it's ever spent on any election in 2008 to try and get Sarah Palin and John McCain into office, they failed because people were very upset at the Republicans. And actually, the Republicans had their lowest number of people in history identifying as Republicans at the end of the Bush administration, even lower than during the Nixon administration. And one of the reasons that people were so mad at this industry, at this administration, was that they saw it as so interwed with the oil industry, and they were very angry at high oil and gas prices. I don't think anyone sees the Obama administration as interwed with oil and gas in the same way, because it just isn't. But it's obvious that the industry has also been equally upset with the Obama administration and isn't quiet about that. So while certainly history tells us that when gas prices go up, voters take that out on elected officials, I actually think that the differences are so stark between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in terms of its relationship to this industry that we're not going to see quite the same anger and negative response to this administration because of the gas prices.
Sue in Glendale, hi.
Hi, I've been listening to the conversation. I'm really enjoying the discussion. I think it's important. I agree that short-term, that speculation and deregulation are driving the prices up. But what about long-term? What about the effect of peak oil? We know that oil is finite and that it's getting more expensive and riskier to extract. And I'm wondering if the energy return on investment is actually starting to fall a little bit because of long-term constraints in the supply.
One of the problems with the peak oil debate is that the window of what the peak is keeps being pushed out. And the reason why it keeps getting pushed out further into the time horizon is because the oil industry keeps finding new ways to find more oil in more and more dangerous places that we never thought they would find before. And also, for that matter, natural gas, fracking and the dangers associated with fracking are processes that would not be being so aggressively applied if the industry wasn't desperately trying to get every ounce of these resources as it could. And so the horizon, the time horizon on peak oil keeps getting moved. And when we, I think, spend too much time talking about peak oil, it creates the opportunity for the oil industry to say, wow, we need to be really, really worried about the fact that this resource is going to run out. and therefore you need to let us go absolutely everywhere we possibly can to get this resource. And I think rather the discussion should be shifted to, right now it is problematic for us to be using this resource. Right now it's causing, you know, climate change, it's causing wars, it's causing vast environmental destruction, like 210 million gallons of oil being spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. And right now we need to think about getting off the resource, because the industry will do everything it can to get every last barrel.
Antonio, we need to end it at this point. Thank you very much for the hour. It was fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Antonio Yuhas, leading oil expert. She is the author of Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, and she's also author of an earlier book, The Tyranny of Oil. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. We were overwhelmed with email responses to this show and phone calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you, but we'll be on the subject again, I am sure. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll continue with another hour of Tuesday conversation with an extraordinary young man. So stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.